Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Friday, December 20th, 2013, and this is Retooling for Our Coming of Age. I am Jeff Dunphy, joined here today with my host, Jimena Ponte. On today's show, we're going to talk about, oh, go figure, gold. We're going to talk about the headlines. We're going to wander around the planet a bit. We're going to talk about the esoteric paradox of the day, which is selflessness versus selfishness. And welcome today, Jimena.
Good morning, Jeff, and good morning, everyone out there. Just a little reminder, as always, you can follow us on Twitter. I will be posting the links from the headlines we talk about today on our Twitter feed, and that is at retoolingdotorg. Let's talk about gold.
Well, I mean, we saw gold drop 20-some-odd dollars yesterday. I mean, we're sitting right now at $1,203.90, which is the lowest it's been for ages. It's last 6 months, I think it was as high as $1,500 or $1,600. And we're now up about $10, $10.30, it looks like, on Bloomberg. I'm equally interested in where gold is going, and I'm also equally interested in how it is being manipulated in some scenarios. And it brings about a conversation that we will be having next week with a friend of mine and a cohort in the gold following business named Brent Johnson, who is from Santiago Capital in the Bay Area. And he and I've done some interesting stuff together, and I've taught some of the little presentations he has given when I was teaching at the University of Calgary just 1 year ago. So let's chat a little about gold. Let's talk a little about China, what's happening in China, and let's chat about a variety of things relative to what's next in terms of where we think the price of gold is going. Are fair and easy and transparent, and we do think that there's maniacal manipulation on the gold markets. We also are of the opinion that because the price of gold has dropped so precipitously, in terms of from a trading aspect, we think that buying gold right now is probably not an unwise decision. It accumulates and you buy, and in the trading business we call this trading down, to average down your effective price. So let's wander up. We also think that the Chinese right now are going in and gobbling up huge amounts of gold, and we think certainly from what I've been reading today, there's a venue of the better part of 750 tons of gold that the Chinese have sort of asked everybody not to pay attention to and then accumulated. Brent is one of the guys that also exposes this as well.
Well, I know that you're speaking from a level of expertise that I would venture to say that most people don't have. And so if we're talking to someone who's just tuning into the show for the first time and they are hearing about gold and they're hearing about it from the sense that it's a commodity that everyone should be collecting or trying to accumulate in their stores because of its vibratory qualities, because of its intrinsic value. What do you say to the person who is just starting to understand this, is somewhat of a newbie as it pertains to gold, and how should they go about first acquiring gold? How does someone who's never bought gold before, where do they go? How do they get it? What's your advice for that person who's just tuning in now for the first time?
Okay, well let's chat a little about jewelry. Well, I mean, gold jewelry, silver jewelry has been around for a long time. Let's talk about ancient civilizations and how they value gold. Let's chat about going to the gold coin stores anywhere in Toronto, in Montreal, in New York, in Chicago, in Detroit, in LA, anywhere on the planet. You can go and Google or go to a Yellow Pages and look up a gold coin store. And you can go in and say, I would like to buy a 1 ounce gold maple leaf, which is a Canadian coin. I'd like to buy an American Eagle, which is an American coin. I'd like to buy a South African Krugerrand, which is a South African coin, go figure. And you go in and you buy these coins. Now, gold is one of those brilliant metals that is untarnishable, keeps forever. In times of turmoil everywhere on the planet, throughout history, as far as we know it, it has always been very valuable, and consequently, it is something that we do not want at any point in time not to have some. So yeah, go to a gold coin store. Go to a coin store.
Great. So what you're saying is that there's a possibility that that there might be some sort of a collapse. There might be some sort of something happening in the world that we might need to use coins to make money or to make exchanges. Is that what you're saying? Is that what the premise behind this is?
Owning gold in this day and age is an unbelievably important thing to do. We think that the economy, the government, the general world in it has been lost in terms of the idiocy that comes about from greed. We are of the mind that the political system is broken. We are of the mind that greed has run its course, and I suspect that we're going to see some unfortunate events happen. And we're also seeing it all come down all the time. We talk about the manipulation in the market. We talk about the political system. We talk about banks in general, too big to fail. I've got a couple of things that I want to share with you in terms of where we think things are going. And I also have some interesting potential predictions from one of the groups or one of the websites that we follow. So yes, owning gold is one of those places to store your wealth, wealth protection. As opposed to wealth creation, we play a mindset that says, let's go into the stock market and win the lottery by investing and making 5 times or 10 times or 20 times your money. We are of the opinion that the stock market is rigged. It is not for the faint of heart, one, and it is not for non-insiders.
And so traditionally what's happened in our culture and in our society in North America is that we've been told that if we put our money into the banks, if we save our money, if we invest our money into stock markets, that is how we are going to create and grow and protect ourselves as it pertains to our personal wealth and our well-being for the future. And so I guess what I'm trying to make clear to anyone who's new, who's just listening to this for the first time, and I apologize to anyone out there who is an expert and wants to get into more of the expertise of this, but for the new people who are just tuning in, gold is basically going to replace that way of thinking, that old way of believing in fiat money, believing in paper cash, in money that doesn't necessarily have intrinsic value.
If you went into a store and used monopoly money to buy groceries, the grocer would say you're nuts. And I think throughout history, having gold coins historically for the last several thousand years, 5 or 10 or however many thousands of years you want to go by, has always been used as a means of exchange. And then the pragmatists in humanity would say, well, why don't we just exchange this piece of paper or 10 or 20 or 50 of these pieces of paper for gold, and we'll have gold backstop the currency, so it's used as a backstop. In the early 70s, in 1973, at the Bretton Woods Agreement, Nixon, who needed to pay for the Vietnam War, he took the U.S. off the gold-backed currency because he could print money to pay for things and he didn't need to backstop it with the physical commodity. And we've been in a slide ever since. Since the development, since the demise of the U.S. dollar in the last 100 years, which we just recently saw the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve Act, where the U.S. government prints money, it has become less and less and less and less valuable. In the last 100 years, what you bought 100 years ago for $1, it costs you $100 to buy today. So we've seen a desperate devaluation of the currency. And now we're also seeing, as a result of the printing of money, we're seeing the various global powers, the various political parties on the globe take exception to the printing of money, take exception to accepting monopoly money in the grocery store. So when we do that, we have banks who are borrowing this money. They aren't lending much of it because it's an economy that is really slow. And we have the very large banks who are gaming the system. Well, again, this is part of the greed is going to blow things up, whereas in the throes of blowing things up, and in fact started the first foot that dropped was in 2008 when they threw Lehman under the bus, when they threw Lehman Brothers under the bus, and when the government had to actually bail everybody out by printing a bunch of money and handing it to them. We now have the balance sheet of the Treasury right now is sitting at $4 trillion. It was $3 trillion just a little while ago. It's because they are printing $85 billion a month of money in order to buy back bonds, which is a bit of a ruse, which Brent may caucus with Brent next week on that. So in the course of this, they're saying they're going to dial this back from $85 to $75 billion. So they're printing a little less money, and the market played and fussed and played around with a bunch of things. So let's wander through a couple of predictions that the Saxo Bank has made that, while they suggest they might be outrageous, it is in keeping with where we think things are going relative to the economy. So remember when Cyprus went up the stump? Remember when they went into Cyprus and they said, you borrowed too much money, but instead of bailing you out, what we will do is we'll go in and steal your bank accounts. So they went in, and a friend of mine and a friend of yours too, they went into his bank account and stole his money.
So that is called a bail-in. Is that correct? So when the government wants to pay off its bills and they go into your bank accounts and they steal the people's money, that is called a bail-in.
Right.
Okay.
When the government wants to pay for the bills by printing more money, which devalues the currency, it's called a bailout. And when they want to steal savers' money, it's called a bail-in. So here's a prediction. The European Union, as a result of deflation and lack of growth, the European Central Bank imposes wealth taxes. This would be a bail-in on anybody with more than 100,000 euros in the bank. Okay, in the name of removing inequality and secure sufficient funds to create a crisis buffer. So consequently, this would be, we can't print money forever. We may have to go and steal people's savings. Next one, following the European Parliament elections in May, a pan-European, anti-EU transnational alliance will become the largest group in Parliament. The new European Parliament chooses an anti-EU chairman, and the European heads of state and governments fail to pick a president of the European Commission. Now, this prediction would suggest that there's going to be some sharp-elbowed positioning on how they're going to run Europe, because ideally those powers that be may want to overlord or overpower the European states. That's what this prediction talks about. Okay?
So just to be clear, these are predictions that have been made by the bank itself, by Saxo Bank.
Yes.
And okay.
And so this, I'm just reiterating them because I want to bounce around where the Saxo Bank thinks things are going, and it sort of ties into and I'm not going to go through all of them today, but I want to wander through some of their observations. We think that they're talking about the Bank of Japan finally, after printing its brains out. They have done no bailing in, but the Bank of Japan and the Japanese government are huge holders of U.S. Treasuries, and they suggest that the desperate Bank of Japan may simply delete all of its government debt securities, a simple but untested accounting trick, and the outcome of which will see a nerve-wracking journey into certainty, complete uncertainty, and potentially a disaster with away. So the Japanese hold a bunch of U.S. securities. The Chinese hold a bunch of U.S. securities. As soon as they start to throw these under the bus, we may see a collapse of things and also rising interest rates. A run on the bank, so to speak, okay?
A run on the bank by the people or a run on the bank by the government?
Their governments. You now have, if everybody showed up in a bank today and asked for their money, that would be a run on the bank by the people.
Right.
However, if the guys that provide liquidity to the banks every day, like the actual Bank of China, the People's Bank, the People's Republican Bank of China, if they just said, because the banks are really, they need money, billions and trillions of dollars every night, and they borrow it overnight. If the Bank of China said, yeah, we're not going to give it to you today, there would be huge turmoil, which is one of the reasons that Lehman Brothers blew up, because they couldn't find anybody to lend the money for one or two or three or four days, because everybody went, holy crap, we may not get it back. So that is where the liquidity market in the world is very fragile. And what's also becoming evident in what is happening is everybody's going, I don't know if I trust you. They're looking around. It's not unlike a game of musical chairs. And so when liquidity gets really weird, people start to pull in their horns. They start to say, I'm not going to lend you money overnight. If and when that happens, crises happen. And it's far bigger, far more dramatic, and hundreds of thousands times more dangerous, because literally in one day overnight, you can have a run on the bank by another bank or by another country that literally throws a wrench in the gears and destroys the system, which is what one of the things that happened to the Lehman Brothers. Okay. Their fifth prediction is, although indicators may suggest that the U.S. economy is stronger, I would suggest that the U.S. economy is stronger is a ruse, and I think there's a website called Shadow Stats, which sort of wanders
through
that.
There's a really good word for that. It's called the propaganda.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. The housing market remains fragile, and wage growth remains non-existent. Well, with Congress scheduled to perform Act 2 of its How to Disrupt the U.S. Economy charade in January, this is the U.S. debt limit, investment, employment, and consumer confidence will once again suffer. This will push inflation down, not up next year, and deflation will again top their scenario of agenda. I would suggest, here's an interesting part of a topic today, was the Blackstone Group is one of the largest fund managers on the planet. In fact, if not the largest. At a time, in 08, when I was still in the business, when I was still in the investment banking business, one of the things that happened in the collapse of the housing market is that a whole group of us got together and said, the thing that we should do is put together a fund and go in and buy these ravaged housing prices. So you'd have a house that was worth 500 grand that would collapse, and you could buy it for 250 grand, 50% on the dollar. Now, these houses have not gone back to 500, but they may be trading at 350 or 4, so there has been some capital appreciation in the last 4 or 5 years. But you can also go and buy them and rent them out. So they, all of a sudden, you could buy something at a low rate and rent them out. Well, Blackstone, as we have seen in the last little bit, Blackstone is one of the largest owners of real estate in the U.S., which is quite an interesting observation. So there's some stuff in there that would suggest that the market manipulators and the market players who were responsible and witness to the housing bubble because of predatory lending, because of elbowing their way in order to maximize their profits, that they now are the landlords and are renting these places out. It's a bit ironic, is it not?
Well, when the world gives you lemons.
Well, and when you control the market.
Make
and when
some
you,
more rotten lemonade.
Yeah, exactly right.
Well, so, it's interesting about this Blackstone group is that it's run by people who previously worked at Lehman Brothers. So this gentleman, Peter G. Peterson and Steven Schwarzman, they worked together previously at Lehman Brothers. So that's interesting too, to see that it's just a bunch of the good old boys that are, they're just the same main players.
Well, I think one of the things that happens on Wall Street is that it's a very transient group. They all bounce around, and as you will see many, many countries, the guys from Goldman Sachs are running various countries. The Blackstone groups, there are some guys in there that used to be in Lehman Brothers, and these guys have been around the street. It's quite an interesting time. So back to these predictions, I want to bounce around through them, but I also want to, they're predicting that Brent crude is going to drop to $80 a barrel. And I think one of the things that has given a bunch of my friends in the market, in the trading venue, quite serious consternation is they don't, for the life of them, understand why the price of oil has been so incredibly high and strong. And again, it talks to another market that we think is being manipulated. With the amount of oil that's happened through non-conventional methodologies of extraction, specifically shale fracturing, when they go in and they fracking. So all of a sudden they find all this oil. It becomes an engineering feat as opposed to an exploration feat. So one of the things that has been incredibly incongruous with the laws of supply and demand is that there's been an enormous amount of oil found in North America, and yet the price of oil is really, really strong. So again, lends us to believe that the oil market is manipulated.
Well,
however, the
is it being manipulated because of the concept of peak oil, because of the concept of hitting the maximum amount of what we are able to dredge? Why is it being manipulated? I mean, there has to be a reason besides just pure greed and profiteering.
And unfortunately, I'd like to say that there would be a perceived aspect of a shortage. But at this instant in time, it is, in my opinion, the price of oil is being purely manipulated, purely greed. Because I think what happens now is that the petroleum companies, the big five or big seven, it used to be the seven sisters, but the big five of the oil and gas companies on the planet are so incredibly powerful that they can control the manipulation of the market. And so consequently, they need to keep it at a certain place and certain numbers. The Saudi Arabian government will define their economic parameters and the way that they play their politics by figuring out how much money they need to spend in order to keep everybody happy in the country. And then they'll say, and that equates to $109, or that equates to $98, even though that they can produce oil out of the ground for dollars on the barrel, $10, $5, $8. They need the price of $80 or $90 in order to facilitate how much money they bring into the country. The Seven Sisters, the petroleum group that produces the BPs of the world, the petroleum,
Exxon Mobil,
all of these groups that produce all of these oil, this oil, are incredibly powerful in their capacity to manipulate the price of oil. So although the Saxo Bank Group suggests that Brent crude drops to $80 a barrel, I would view this as a wonderful thing. But I also think that the non-conventional methodology of production has increased the supply of oil, and consequently I'm surprised that it hasn't dropped sooner. They're also suggesting that Germany may go into recession. The German economy, in my opinion, certainly what little I know about it and having traveled there a few times, but what I get is that Germany in and of itself has a brilliant economy and has a brilliant mindset and economic predisposition towards being diligent in their world. But I think Germany is an island unto itself. I think France is having serious challenges. I think the Holland government in France is a bit bereft of validity. And I think Germany, I just don't think Germany can continue to perform, and nor do the Saxon Bank as well. And they also suggest that France is going to collapse. So, and they're also talking about the tapering of quantitative easing falling, and consequently the U.S. dollar gaining a bit more strength relative to the other five currencies. So there's the Saxo Bank's predictions for 14, and we step into our next topic of account.
I wanted to talk about an interesting article that I found on a very interesting website called Police State USA. It's an independent website that documents different accounts from all over the United States, basically talking about all of the ways people's rights are being ignored, compromised. And there's a particular article that I found on here that's talking about roadblocks that are being set up all over the U.S. in order to harvest people's DNA samples. And so these roadblocks were placed under the guise of a study. And they were studying whether or not people were driving under the influence of prescription drugs, alcohol, any type of substance that might inhibit their ability to drive. And so they would stop the cars and they would ask them if they wanted to have a DNA test, either a swab or a draw blood for cash. And so, but it was optional. It was an optional study. And so the people had the option of declining or taking the cash. And there was a lot of personal accounts of individuals who were, they would decline the $10 offer, and then they'd say, well, we'll give you $100. But the main point of the article is it actually voluntary? Is it voluntary when you're driving your car and you haven't done anything wrong and a police officer is telling you to stop? Is that voluntary? And what does it say about our society and culture when the federal government of the United States is going into communities in individual states and demanding that these studies be done and that people's lives are interrupted and that our DNA is being taken for what? They're saying that it's under the guise of a study, but how do we trust that? It's obviously not voluntary.
it smacks of one of the things we talked about, the 10 steps to close an open society. It smacks of a violation of the Fourth Amendment in a appropriate search and seizure. And it also smacks about something, another agenda. Pay attention. This is a police state scenario. I mean, and according to the article, it also talks a little about they weren't particularly sure whether it was voluntary or not. There was lots of arm twisting in this. These are things that the media doesn't cover. These are things that fall between the cracks, and these are things that we'd like to hear from you if at any point in time you're happy to let us know. Has anybody who listens been involved in watching these and heard of any of these things? This is the kind of expose that we want to be able to do. We call this retooling in order that people can see what's going on and take exception to it. There's a very simple mindset in all of this, is we're trying to turn the lights on so people can see what is rather than what they're being told or what they're being propagandized on.
So the reason I brought this article up, and I know it's kind of a jump from what we were previously talking about, we're talking about banks and we're talking about a possible collapse and we're talking about people being aware of what's happening with your money, but I think it's also really important to be aware of what's happening in communities all over North America and be aware of how people are being injected with fear and how people's rights are being absolutely compromised. And so it's a bit of a jump, but at the same time, it's so important to have a full scope, a full view of all the different ways that people are being abused, our rights, our human rights are being abused.
And I'd like to point out that while it is we think of ourselves as North Americans, I think there's these human rights violations are far more prevalent in the U.S. than they are in Canada. Canada is not nearly as vile, if you will, as they are in the States. And certainly we hear about these things in the States, and the U.S. press misses these things completely. There was a thing that was happening in U.S. airports where the guys that would frisk you and search you, the TSA, it's called.
TSA, yeah. Thank you.
So, but what these guys would do is they were told that after you left, so after you put your shoes back on and after you got your briefcase and after you left, as you walked away, they did a test a little while ago and they said, "Excuse me, sir, please stop," to which they don't have any authority to do. But what they were doing is testing the psychology that if they had the authority to make people stop, and people would stand by and say, "Hey, that guy's telling you to stop." And in fact, they had no authority to stop you once they frisked you to see if you were carrying something nasty that might hurt people. So there's an interest, again, it's turning into, it is tending towards a police state, which gives me great, great pause. And back to the NSA that we dealt with last week in terms of spying and securities and all the other stuff, right?
Yes. And that's a beautiful segue into this next headline that we found about the NSA and actually getting some blowback in a way that I'm sure the U.S. is very, very unhappy about. So, I mean, there's actions, but then there's consequences for your actions. And so the people are being subjected to these involuntary searches. They're being subjected to these DNA tests, all things that feel wrong and feel gross and are egregious in terms of how it violates our rights. But at the same time, there's also a lot of whistleblowing happening, and there's a lot of people speaking up and fighting back and saying no to these types of things. And why don't we just talk about this headline about what happened in Brazil and as it pertains to the NSA? I love this.
Well, part of Snowden's expose and part of him dishing on a bunch of stuff, and part of he runs to Russia. There's some interesting backstory to this, in that in terms of what he exposed about the NSA is that it showed that the NSA was spying on a whole bunch of its allies, to which his allies got, "What the hell? Like, I don't get this. You're spying on us? This has been exposed," to which the U.S. gets all up in, "Oh, well, that's treason and that's all this nonsense." It isn't so much treason. How and why are you spying on your allies? And so what happened is that the Brazilians were in the middle of looking to buy something from Boeing, and in fact it was a $4 or $5 billion it was a $4.2 billion purchase, and they said, "We can't do this because the U.S. is spying on us." Now the other thing that's presented itself too is that the U.S. are now talking about clemency or waiving all the charges about Snowden, given that he stops disclosing.
Or that he returns the documents. But the funny thing is that he doesn't even have the documents. The documents are in the hands of a gentleman called Glenn Greenwald and a woman called Laura Poitras.
Right.
So I'm not sure.
And they're all, but also one of the things that also presents itself in that is, are all the documents out there? Do these guys have all the documents? And is there more? One of the things that makes me suspicious about the Americans saying, no, we'll happily let you back in the country, is maybe there's other stuff that they know may be imminently coming out that's going to outrage people even more. The outrage in this, the turning on the lights, the expose, the whistleblowers, it's a ball. It's a snowball rolling, and hopefully we get more and more and more of it where they can't, it's sticking a finger in the dike, no longer works.
Right, but the U.S. is, it's no secret that the United States government, with its face of Barack Obama, has no problem droning people, droning 16-year-old boys who are American citizens. If these documents are so damaging and classified, why haven't they done anything about it? Is it that they don't have that power? Does the biggest country in the most powerful country in the world, who has the largest military in the world, and all of these Navy SEALs and all of this amazing ability to spy on people, do they not have the ability to shut these three people up who have all this damning information?
Well, I mean, when you do read the information and the take on various places, I think what happens is there is an aspect of technology that sometimes can get away from you. And the getting away from you is that you just don't understand how exposed you are. You don't understand where the back door is to things. And it's not unlike you get a security company to come to your house and say, where am I vulnerable? Well, let's deadbolt the front door, let's deadbolt this, but then you see that maybe it's through the roof that nobody ever thought about. It's the spy movie or the cat burglar movie. In technology, there are vulnerabilities of systems because a system is quite complicated, quite complex, and has all kinds of potential backdoors and the like. So what does present itself oftentimes is Snowden was in Hawaii and he sort of discovered a backdoor to this and he started to extricate all this information. Of course they're vulnerable, but we would like to think from an esoteric point of view that the lights turn on, the expose starts, and the outrage of the people is so strong that they stop believing the nonsense they're being told, and they start to question. They start to say, I don't believe what you're telling me. I think that this is nonsense, and I think that this is turning into more and more into a police state. And then the Americans finally go, oh my goodness, okay. One of the things that there was a lovely book that was written in the 80s, believe it or not, called Blood in the Streets by a guy named Rhys Moeg and John Davidson.
The title doesn't sound very lovely.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And it was lovely in terms of it talked about how over time, this book was written 30 years ago now, but how over time, the U.S. would not be able to police the world. And one of the things that is now happening, and certainly on the liberal sites, is we're starting to see, is it the U.S.'s position and place to police the world? Because what we're now starting also to see is that the Americans are now starting to want to create a police state. The Iraq War veterans came back, and the Boston Marathon bombing, they all came back and they said, wow, all that equipment we were using in Iraq and in Afghanistan, they've just painted it blue. So there is a bit of a militarized state going on in the States.
It's not a bit. It's absolutely blatant.
Yeah. And so, yeah, the NSA blowback, they're losing contracts. There's a whole bunch of distrust. There's a whole bunch of, I don't believe what you're saying. And there's a whole bunch of, well, the lights are now on so brightly that perhaps this expose alleviates our sheeple from their being led down a path that they don't want to be led down. And maybe one of the things that there's another controversy in this in terms of the DNA sampling that we just talked about, and it is there has been a dumbing down of the population, much like what they did to the Jews in the concentration camps in Germany. They fed them drugs to make them more acquiescent, more easily led, less able to rise up and take exception to this stuff. And part of that lends itself to, they're trying to figure out how best to drug down, dumb down, make the population acquiescent so they take direction. They don't question authority, and they just act as sheeple.
Well, I personally love talking about energetics. I I love talking about the human subtle body and the biomagnetic energy field that surrounds the human body. And most people are completely unaware of it. Most people don't realize that it exists, and most people don't know that much about it. But we do have an energy system around our bodies, and it's where our thoughts live, it's where our emotions live, and it's how we interact with the outside world and with one another. And it is highly toxins, environmental toxins, by emotional stress, by negative thoughts. It's compromised by all of these things and by poor nutrition. And so that what you just said is absolutely true. And I believe that at a higher level in government, this is well-known information. And I believe that this is another way that people are being compromised and being violated, because they don't know this about themselves. They don't know that there is an energy field around their bodies that they have control over, and that the toxins in the environment and the toxins that in their food and the stress levels and all types of things affect this little force field that is around their bodies.
No, that was a very good point. Absolutely a very good point. And I also think one of the things that happens in terms of the agenda of big anything, whether it's big pharma, whether it's big food, whether it's big government, whether it's big banks, whether it's anybody who has a very strong economic agenda, one of the things they do, because I used to be involved in that, one of the things they do is they don't let the underlings know what they're doing for fear of being whistleblown. So part of that is they don't want people to know what they're doing. And so consequently, I mean, we can talk about HAARP, and we will talk about HAARP at some period of time. We have a whole bunch of underlings who are just being led down the garden path. And then what happens is when they discover what's going on, like Snowden does, he goes, whoa, we need to talk about this. We need to tell people about it. Hopefully, there are people that are stepping up to the plate and saying, I can no longer in good conscience let this kind of stuff happen. But then what did the top guys do? We have to keep them further and further and further detached, out of the loop.
Okay, so let's get back to basics for a second, and let's discuss what are the tools for someone who is learning this stuff. And I know from personal experience that when you're just figuring out that a lot of these things are a farce, that you're not necessarily being told the truth by establishments and governments and things that you would have trusted in the past, what's your advice to individuals when they're just learning this, and how do they incorporate it into their lives?
Part of retooling is being skeptical. Part of being skeptical is trying to figure out what is it that they are up to that may be in their best interest but not in yours. Part of it is watching how the government works. Part of it is paying attention to websites. Part of it is listening to conversations about how they are manipulated. But also part of it is taking responsibility for what they're doing and where they're at. Because I do think, and I think it's probably in any kind of conversation, any cocktail party, any conversation, when you say greed has run amok and it blows itself up, not very many people will look at that and say, yeah, I disagree. Certainly in my experience. I do think that we have a system that is more invested in it being kept whole than in serving the people that the system was originally put in place for.
So I agree with you. I agree with that. But I also wanted to put in there's a difference between being skeptical, and there's a difference between being cynical, and there's a difference between being skeptical, cynical, or pessimistic. And I think that it's important to be skeptical, but also to be optimistic and to hold positive thoughts for what could happen in the future. I know that it's important to hold positive thoughts and to create positive outcomes and to focus on more positive outcomes as opposed to only focusing on the negative. And I tend to see that in the media we only see negativity. We're not being shown a lot of the positive things that are happening in the world, and there are plenty.
Without doubt. one of the things that happens in the collapse of this system that I think is imminent, and all the signs are pointing to it, is that something of a better order is coming about. It will make people more self-reliant. It will make people less trusting of, for want of a better phrase, evil agendas of others. And it will make those people who become the new ruling people, the new self-governing people, it will become, they will become more invested in moving forward. The old system, in my opinion, in our opinion, the old system has to collapse because greed has run its course. You have too many people being violated by the agenda of the few and the powerful, that will change. And because the top greed implosion is a freeing act. It's horrible on one side, but it's the phoenix rising out of the ashes on the other. And it is part of retooling. It's part of the system retooling. It's part of us retooling. It's part of us being skeptical but not cynical. And it's part of us looking forward to the change because it has to happen. It's an evolutionary process in the following through of mankind to reach into new, different, higher realms.
Yes, indeed. I agree. So are we moving on? Are we still on headlines?
Well, I want to chat a little about an article that was posted on, do we need a banking sector anymore? And then I want to fall into something of a bit more philosophical nature. And that is the banking community was put in place long, long, long time ago, where savers got together with borrowers and traded capital. We now have a system, potentially we have a system, we have the technology in place where could we do without the banking system? And, you know, the article goes on to say that, in fact, he thinks that we could, that the technology is in place where we could have a very transparent, a very open banking system, not unlike a PayPal or not unlike any of the online things, where if you do business with borrower good and everybody goes, yes, lovely, everything worked okay, the paperwork went okay, or borrower bad, late, stay away from this guy, here you go. The transfer of money from savers to borrowers and how it could be facilitated in a way where we extricate ourselves from the greed of the banks. What has happened now is that the banking function, years and years and years ago, the Dow Jones, the earnings on the Dow Jones were constituted by 80 or 90% businesses who created something. The earnings of the Dow Jones right now is constituted 40% of earnings or 30% of earnings by financial institutions, which don't do anything. All they do is they're intermediaries and they're financial intermediaries. They just take a cut of things on the way through. That is a very vampiristic, is there such a word as vampiristic? That's a very vampiristic way of thinking that the Dow Jones and the financial institutions who just take a piece on the way through are the engine that runs an economy. So it's an extractive rather than a contributive part of the economy.
Fine, but I want to know what your opinion is on companies. So you use PayPal as an example, but what about the fact that PayPal denied people from donating to WikiLeaks? So PayPal and MasterCard, they denied individuals from donating money to WikiLeaks because there was an agenda behind that. So how can banking be more transparent when there's always a guy at the top who says, yes, 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 no, 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 no for you, and okay, you're okay. How can it be available to everyone?
Great point. And that, again, that's part of creating a system that is transparent and not having these systems sell out. I mean, I do think that PayPal sold out. PayPal was started by a guy named Elon Musk, who was the archetype of Tony Stark in the Iron Man movies. And he was absolutely brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And he sold it out. And by selling it out, it then has an agenda. And it's not unlike what we talked about last week, was with Randolph Hearst making a big fuss with Orson Welles and blackballing Orson Welles so he couldn't work for years and years and years. So yes, there is an agenda. There's the skepticism. There's the, do these people have an agenda? And there are certain people on the web who have fabulous blog talks that are independent. So their funding and their contributions and their how they do it is created in independence, which is how you and I operate. There is an independent here. We are independent. Nobody's telling us what to talk about and what to say. And it is our agenda to instigate retooling, but also to talk about the flow of skepticism, the flow of reading between the lines, the flow of understanding other people's agendas, and to give an alternative viewpoint to what mass media or mainstream media, which is the same thing, which is controlled by just a small handful of people, has relative to where we're going on this.
So let's get into our esoteric paradox of the day, which I wrote a handy-dandy little blog on our website, which you can visit, and it's retooling.org. That's retooling.org. And you can go there and you can check out our links for our show, and you can read our blog, and you can learn a little bit more about us if you wish. But selfishness versus selflessness. It seems paradoxical because do you need one in order to have the other? So do you need to be selfish in order to be selfless?
Okay, so let's wander through real life examples of selflessness, and let's wander through how some great minds of our time, guys way smarter than us, have viewed that and sort of integrated into our bigger understanding. So let's chat about a fireman saving a car accident victim. He comes to a car accident victim, and a victim is about to fall off a cliff or a ledge. And the fireman puts himself in great danger in order to reach out and save an individual. And one of the things that happens at the time, and sometimes it's successful, so the fireman reaches down, he grabs the guy by the belt, grabs him, holds on to a ledge, and pulls himself into a place that that saves the individual. And everybody around is clapping, and they're going, what a selfless way, right? What a selfless way. Now, one of the things that does present itself, we had a techno glitch in here. One of the things that does present itself is that everybody collapses and says, what were you doing? What were you thinking? And he said, I wasn't thinking. I was treating that individual almost as if it was myself. Another thing that just happened recently in the New York subway, it was either New York or London, but it was a white guy fell off the platform. And standing there, everybody stood around and looked as the train was approaching. And a black guy jumped on top of him, laid down on top of him under the tracks, and the train rolled over both of them. And the train's clearance was 22 inches or 23 inches, and their clearance was 21. So it missed them by an inch.
But why is race important in that story? Is race important in that story because it's happening in the United States and race is important in the United States? Or?
Well, it's talking about selflessness. And it's talking about the fact that in a society where there is a race differential and a race awareness, that somebody can be so selfless as to save a white guy being a black guy. And everybody just sort of said, dude, what were you thinking? And he said, I wasn't. I just was thinking if I was that guy, I was thinking as if I was him. And so part of the Bill Moyers and Joseph Campbell series that happened years ago was Joseph Campbell's observation. He was a magic individual. One of his observations was that you are one and the same. You are one and the same. So when you reach out to save somebody, you do not differentiate between who that person is and who you are. So when you look into another's eyes, you go, you're exactly like me. You're in a different package. But the eyes are the window to the soul. You are me. So consequently, at that moment in time, there is this special magic transcendent event that happens, that where you lose yourself in the aid of another, and that's where this selflessness presents itself. And so as we talk into the paradox of that, is there's a phrase that I used often in university in my lectures, and it talked about as go we, so go I, which talks about the greater good throughout history and throughout these extraordinary people who have done extraordinary things in their life, Gandhi, for example. But one of the messages was, as go we, so go I. So there's something about the greater good of all.
So then let's have a real life example of selfishness and how important for this conversation in general. So my viewpoint of how one would need to be selfish before they could be selfless is the example of a woman who is taking care of her sick sibling, a sibling that's very sick, and spending all the time and energy to take care of this person, but at the same time not taking care of their own individual needs. So not taking care of their own nutrition, not taking care of their own emotional health, not doing the things that they need to do for their own, their self. And they're spending all their energy taking care of this other person. And this resentment builds. And so in this person's inability to take care of themselves, they're not able to be selfless because they are... How can you be selfless if you are not taken care of, if you don't take care of your own body, your own needs?
Okay. And so you violate yourself in order to take care of another. Is that what I just heard?
Right.
Okay. So, and oftentimes there is sort of we would call that in the psychological approach, the martyrdom approach. How you can violate your own self in order to help others, thinking that the violation of yourself, the martyrdom of yourself, is an honorable thing to do. And yes, that is self-destructive, and that is not a progressive act. And in the same breath, there are aspects of looking out after others to the best of your ability, as opposed to the interesting irony in that. Where does that train go? You kill yourself in order to be kind to others. So pretty soon you can't look after your sick sister because you're sick yourself. You're destroying yourself.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think that the concept of selflessness is a beautiful concept and it's something to strive for. But my point is that in order for anyone to help another, to heal another, to be a healer, to complete acts of selfless, and a selfless act is something that doesn't require reward or recognition or acknowledgement. You do it just because it's the right thing to do, and you're doing it out of love, and you love someone, and you want to help them. You're not looking for money. You're not looking for recognition. You're not looking for fame. All that stuff is completely unimportant. It's not important.
It's not even considered.
It's not exactly. It's not even considered. But my point is that a person can't get to that place unless they have taken care of their own personal needs first, unless they have loved themselves.
Okay. And I think, but I also think being lost in the moment, I mean, there's a potential for that to be the case. And I think there is this is a wonderful esoteric conversation, and it's, can you be, is the firefighter who comes and saves you, is he in perfect alignment with himself and taking care of himself? Well, maybe not necessarily, but at the moment that he is completely selfless, he loses himself in the other. And so it never occurs to him his own peril. He's not thinking, ooh, I'm going to hurt myself by trying to save this individual. He gets lost in the moment. And I think there's the progress of selfishness that from the other side is the best way to be selfish is to create an environment around you where you are serving of others in a healthy, wonderful, conscious, conscientious way. And so you can't necessarily do that if you're ill or if you're ill prepared, if you are ill-nourished, any of that stuff. You become less and less of a vehicle. There's a wonderful statement in esoteric writings that it's called, allow me to be a perfect instrument in the hand of God, which would be allow the genius of myself to shine through me. How best to allow the genius to shine through you? By creating a vessel, a vehicle, that is harmonious, in alignment, not upset, not cranked, not ill-nourished or malnourished. But it also doesn't preclude those people who do not have perfect instruments by acting selflessly.
So then what you're saying is that selflessness can happen in moments, all the time, by anyone.
Yes.
And what I'm saying is that someone who wants to dedicate themselves to service, to being selfless, to being a healer, to serving humanity, must make concentrated effort to make sure that they are spending that love on themselves so that they have a nice, clear, open, loving vehicle in order to go forward with that.
In order to facilitate their genius, yes. And I want to chat a little about the medical community and something that we were talking about earlier today, and that would be the medical community that we have right now is, in a sense, it's a disease care system. It doesn't deal with health care. It deals with disease care. And so there are places, there are cultures in the world where the medical doctors, or the medicine men, if you will, the medicine men have an obligation to the society at the time to keep everybody healthy. So they get paid every day a little bit. Here you go. I'm healthy today. Thank you. And his whole objective is to make sure that everything runs smoothly and everybody is healthy. And the second anybody gets diseased or gets unhealthy or comes down with some malady, they stop paying him. So his motivation is the antithesis of the other side. So you go into a doctor who's great, big, and overweight and fat and smokes cigarettes, and his whole motive is some guy walks in and says, you got prostate cancer. We're going to go in and dig out your prostate. And the doctor earns money by doing that. Come on in. Let me cut that thing out. And the guy goes, well, just a second. I'm not sure if I want to do that. Are there other alternatives? Or is there a different way to do that? And the doctor says, dude, you just have to let me cut it out. Well, is his motivation selfish? Is the only reason he's doing this is because he's going to earn an extra $2,000 or $3,000? Is the profit motive now derailing our tending to other people? The doctor in a society outside of the norm, the Western one, he goes, you're ill, so you're not paying me. So it's my objective to get you well again. How best to get you well? We will see in the coming time, in the coming era, that there will be an esoteric approach to healing people, as you're conversing with, that there is something more to the physical than meets the eye. And conventional medicine is actually going there. They're now starting to see that attitude. They're now starting to see that energetics. They're now starting to see that the mental approach to getting well is unbelievably contributory. And again, it brings us back into a place that we trust there is a paradigm shift about to happen in the normal course of the evolution of humanity. And it happens in a way that suggests that we are waking up as opposed to staying asleep. In my brief vignette and introduction to medical school, I had old women were suggesting, doctor, doctor, help me, when I was just a teenager. And it was devastating. It was horrible because they were saying, you take responsibility for my health. Perhaps in the new age, everybody takes responsibility for their health by being selfish about their health. But it translates into selflessness about how they can best facilitate their genius, their calling, their act of service.
Maybe a blog topic for this week, Professor?
Perhaps it could be. This week would be the week of little baby Jesus' birth in Will Ferrell's. It's his birthday this week, ain't it?
It sure is. It's
Ricky Bobby. Ricky Bobby loves baby Jesus.
Well, we are coming to a close at our show. Next week is Christmas, so we wish all of you a happy, happy holiday. And we will be on the air as usual on and we will have Brent,
Friday, December 27th.
We will have Brent Johnson from San Diego Capital on the show with us. So please join us next week.
Thank you very much. Thank you for allowing us to be of service. Thank you for us to blather on, and we very much look forward to chatting with you next week. Retooling for our coming of age. Thank you.